Hello, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Peters, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Dean Welty. We've got a great program planned for you today, and we are so glad you have joined us for it again. One quick thing that we want to make you aware of is that this program is a rebroadcast discussing my book, Restoring America's Soul. Now, I wrote the book when I was still Rita Dunaway, but don't let that throw you. It's still me, and I hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway, and we are entering the final leg of our journey through Rita's new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. She's putting everything together in this last chapter today as she takes on the huge challenge of what she calls restoring a culture of virtue in America. But before we begin, and particularly for those who may be joining us for the first time, let's take a quick look at the last several weeks of programs to provide some background for today's topic. To begin, Rita emphasized that as Bible-believing constitutional conservatives, we should focus on what we are for rather than just what we are against. We want to conserve from our past all that is good. We also talked about the importance of tone and civility in our debates, especially on the hot-button issues of politics, religion, and morality. But that also means that we need to listen to each other. Then we moved on to the importance of making decisions on what we know to be true and good rather than on our feelings, which often get us into trouble by telling us, if it feels good, do it. And then we looked back at how our conservative principles grew out of our Judeo-Christian heritage and how they helped the Founding Fathers shape our constitutional system of limited government. Then we looked at contrast between liberals and conservatives, and who does a better job of caring for the poor, liberals or conservatives? Well, that was an interesting discussion, and then that took us into some conflicts involving our religious freedoms. For example, when LGBT activists challenge our rights of conscience not to participate in or support same-sex wedding celebrations, who wins? There's a similar conflict then between an unborn baby's right to life and the mother's right to choose whether to have it aborted or not. In that case, too, who wins? And then we took on the case for natural marriage because over time, and unfortunately, it has become optional through cohabitation before marriage, disposable through easy divorce, and now even redefinable through same-sex marriage. That is wrong. And then last week, we looked at how government has gotten too big, too powerful, and too intrusive into areas of authority that belong to the states and to the people. Therefore, the challenge is, what can we do to put it back in its place? Well, that's the background, and it brings us to this final chapter. It's a bittersweet day, Rita, this final chapter in which she takes us on the challenge of what we can and must do to restore a culture of virtue in America. But there's one more thing. Some people are still asking, who is this Rita, this little David who expects to take down this giant Goliath? And what qualifies her to take on this daunting task of restoring America's soul? Well, for starters, she's a constitutional attorney with honors degrees from West Virginia University and the Washington and Lee University School of Law. She's worked as staff counsel for the Rutherford Institute, as allied attorney for Alliance Defending Freedom, and is now the National Legislative Strategist for the Convention of States Project. She's also a syndicated columnist who's written for numerous media outlets, including her column for the Daily News Record, and, of course, she also serves as co-host of these Crossroads programs. So, Rita, against that long background, let's move on to today's topic. It's obvious to all of us that we have a huge problem in our culture. As one writer put it 14 years ago, our culture has gone stark, raving, mad. That was 14 years ago. I wonder how she would describe it today. Now, to get us started on this final chapter with you, Rita, we'll start with a quote that you use from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. Let me just read that for us. He says, "The early Christians rejoiced when they redeemed worthy to suffer for what they believed. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles or popular opinion. The church was a thermostat that transformed the mores of society." Why did you start with that quotation?
Well, Dean, I think this is really the key, in a way, to everything else in the book. Our big challenge as Christians living in a post-truth culture where mainstream society has bought into this idea that people should be guided by their feelings and that government is the highest authority is, how do we advocate for goodness, truth, and beauty? We're called to advocate for virtue, not just to reflect what's going on around us in society.
Well, Rita, I really like that reference to what the church should be, not just a social society that enjoys the fellowship, and not just a thermometer that measures changes in our culture, but also as a thermostat that helps direct those changes. And it reminds me of a verse that you often use when you're autographing books, that we are to be above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom we are to shine as lights in the world. That pretty well describes where we are today. And you go on to say, Rita, that working toward good law and wise public policy is essential, but it's not the only or even the primary arena where we should be working.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's an important thing for us to discuss, because especially for those of us who are active politically and involved in the public policy process, it can be very tempting. We can fall into this trap of becoming solely focused on politics and, you know, lawmaking, public policy. But the most effective place for us to start is in our own homes with our own families. And I don't just mean that we tell our kids, you know, what our position is, what's the bottom line on these issues, you know, abortion, marriage, caring for the poor. We need to explain to them and actually engage them in discussions about the very deep why behind our position in order to actually demonstrate to them the beauty of conservatism, the good behind it, and ensure that they will ultimately embrace it deeply as their own worldview, not just, well, I'm going to vote this way because my mom voted this way, but that they'll understand it and embrace it. If we give them a half-hearted explanation of our policy positions, I think one of two things is likely to happen. First, they might actually adopt our position on a particular issue as their own, but it's not going to be a deep commitment to conservatism. It's not going to be the kind of commitment that will hold up under pressure, or that they will be persuasively and winsomely able to convey to others. I think the second thing that can happen is that our kids and grandkids can grow up with this view of conservatism as merely a blind commitment to tradition and past practices, which they will then just shed whenever they're confronted by ridicule or by the immediate appeal of liberalism with its promise of this government-constructed utopia. So it's really important, Dean, that we engage our kids and help them to understand why we believe as we do.
And it is a reality. That is certainly what they're going to face when they go off to a four-year liberal arts college. They're going to face that ridicule.
Absolutely. It's guaranteed.
They have to be prepared. Well, Rita, I really love that you give readers a whole list of practical things that we can do on a regular basis at home to foster a conservative renaissance in society. Let's talk about some of those.
Okay, one thing I suggest is read a newspaper article with your kids, or have older kids read an article on their own from the newspaper and then summarize it for you. Teach them how to analyze and think about what is being reported and to identify ways that the media or the interviewees distort reality. Teach them how to look out for that.
Well, that's a great idea, Rita. And we often assume, I think, that our children will learn good values by osmosis from their daily contact with us.
Yeah.
But it's especially important in our world today to help them verbalize and discuss what they see and believe, because there's such a wide range of media outlets that they're exposed to, including print, TV, radio, internet, and social media. What else can we do?
Well, when we watch the news or discuss current events at home, take the time to explain why we support certain laws or policies and oppose others. Be diligent in explaining the opposite point of view as well and why we reject it. Give them that deep understanding and then ask them to explain it back to you and make sure they're listening and understanding.
Well, on that point, Rita, how can we help them choose between the materials they can trust and those they should avoid? After all, we become what we consume. If you tell me where you go for the news, I can pretty well tell you what your values, your beliefs, and your politics are. So how do we deal with choosing the right materials?
I think just generally teaching them the value of critical thinking and to question, this was just said on this TV news program. How does that line up with what we know to be true? How does that line up with God's word? And we have to get them really in the practice and habit of doing that. And I'll tell you, as a mom, having worked fairly diligently at this over the years, it's so gratifying when you see your kids start to do this on their own. It is a beautiful thing. Another thing, Dean, that I think is really important, especially with what we're hearing a lot about the whole socialism press in today's society, talk frequently with your kids about the virtue of work. Openly resist this idea that a lot of times we glean from what we see in the news and in political debates, this idea that work is just a necessary evil. Well, that is not what the Bible teaches about work. We need to help our kids see that work is a good thing. Encourage them to find work that they love to do and then to do it for the best of their ability.
Great point, Rita. We seem to be living at a time when work has become something to be avoided if we can get what we need without having to work for it.
Right.
And that includes doing chores at home as well as getting outside jobs that provide them with work experience and a paycheck. And it teaches all of us accountability and discipline.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I recommend, Dean, is become a student of history with your kids and grandkids. And this is a challenge to me because I wasn't a big fan of history as a kid. And it's because to me, it was always presented as a list of dates and wars that I needed to memorize. But history is fascinating when it's presented as a story. And that's what it is. So talk to them. Talk to your kids about lessons learned from key historical events.
Well, along with that, Rita, we have the advantage of living here in the heart of history, close to Washington, D.C., as well as in the Civil War arena. So it's easy to take the family on a day trip to some of those areas. And I like the quote from Woodrow Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, when he said, "If we don't know where we came from, how can we know who we are and where we're going? Knowing our history is so important."
You know, I recently had the privilege of hearing George Will, the columnist, speak at an event, and he went so far as to say that understanding history and just the context that we live in today is absolutely essential to being able to engage in a civil way in public policy debates. Another thing I suggest, Dean, is be absolutely certain that your kids and grandkids understand the purpose of government. Repeat this part of the Declaration of Independence to them so often that it rolls off their tongues. Let them get tired of hearing you say it. And then when you discuss government programs, ask them if those programs fit within the purpose of government.
Well, Rita, I think you're referring to the part where it talks about our inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and emphasizes that the purpose of government is to secure
yes.
these rights. I would just add to that, Rita, that the Bible is also a good thing to read and to memorize. And when we talk about being able to roll excerpts from the Declaration of Independence off our tongues, I'd like to be able to do that with Scripture
oh,
as well.
Yeah.
Excerpts from the Bible should also pop into our minds to help guide us in the many decisions we need to make every day.
Absolutely. And again, on the theme of understanding the purpose of government, make sure your family understands the difference between the federal government with specific enumerated powers and then, on the other hand, the state governments with broad and general powers.
That is so important. And I know that some of our political leaders today like to talk about a constitutional crisis in government today. And I'd say one of the biggest crises in America today is our indifference to the constitutional limits on our federal government, usurping powers that rightfully belong to the states and to the people, as is so clearly stated in the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. That's a crisis.
Well, here's another suggestion, Dean, and it's a big one in today's culture. We need to, as parents and grandparents, identify and oppose unjust forms of discrimination, bigotry, and hatred. We need to teach our kids to distinguish those from this wrong idea that equality requires us to manipulate the system so that everyone has the same level of income, no one achieves more than anyone else. We need to teach them to distinguish about what equality really means and what really is bigotry and unlawful discrimination.
Well, you referred to it, the problem with calls for a universal minimum wage, or even the calls for gender equality that would allow men to use women's restrooms and to compete in women's sporting events.
I would also say we need to know what our kids are being taught at school and help them to analyze and evaluate what they're learning. Again, teach them critical thinking.
Well, and Rita, I would point specifically to the family life education classes. When students are exposed without parental notification or consent to sexual behaviors that violate religious beliefs and even common sense sexual practices.
Here's another big one, Dean. In our words, actions, and attitudes, we have to manifest a profound respect for all human life and the steadfast belief that every single human being has unique value and inherent worth. That's so important. And I think it's hard for us to realize sometimes how much our kids are picking up from us, our attitudes toward people, and those latent beliefs about the value of human life.
This time in our history, Rita, I think we need to take every opportunity to add our voices and our feet in standing up for life. And that can include volunteering at pregnancy life centers, help centers, participating in pro-life rallies, and encouraging our legislators to stand for life in every possible way.
Another one that may be surprising to some people is that I recommend, and I really learned this from the author Paul Tripp, who is a great author, I highly recommend. But he talks about taking advantage of our older kids' interest in popular entertainment. Listen to music with them, watch TV with them, read with them, and then help them to actually analyze and think about the themes and worldviews that are being communicated. When you watch a movie, talk about, well, how did it present the view of what it is to be a man or what it is to be a woman or what is good, what is noble? And then how does that line up with the moral law? I think it's so important for us to take the time to do that.
Well, we have a great example, Rita, and you go on in your chapter to talk about William Wilberforce, who lived in Great Britain in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and he led an effort there to end slavery. But what a lot of people don't realize is that Wilberforce had a second great mission in his life, what he called the Reformation of Manners. It sounds like you'd like to see something similar in America.
Absolutely. I love the description of that effort in Eric Metaxas' book, Amazing Grace. He explained that Wilberforce wasn't just talking about etiquette, the way we use manners today. Wilberforce, and this is a quote by Metaxas, he wished to bring civility and self-respect into a society that had long since spiraled down into vice and misery. Dean, don't you think that is exactly what we need today in America?
Well, he said it more elegantly than this other writer who said that our culture is going stark raving mad. It's spiraling down into vice and misery. But as he points out, other people have written that we need to address small things before they become big things. But Rita, what would you say are some of the main areas where our society needs a reformation of manners?
Well, I'll start with a big one, and it's the whole area of sexual modesty. Our culture has just been taken over by just insanity with regard to the whole issue of sex. Everywhere you turn, you are assaulted by innuendo, sexual images, and every other possible type of appeal to your sexual nature. So we can pay as much lip service as we like to virtues such as sexual morality and modesty, but as long as we maintain an accepting attitude toward the sheer volume of material in homes, schools, shopping malls, movie theaters, radios, of all the sexual material, messaging, clothing, pictures, we're going to continue to feed this sexual insanity in our culture. We need to begin to champion the virtue of modesty and restraint. And we do that by pointing toward the goodness and beauty of sex in its proper context, which is marriage.
You also then go on to talk about what is happening to this whole gender debate in New York City, for example, that has in place a transgender rights bill which prohibits a number of forms of discrimination against individuals who have some pretty creative interpretations of gender. And as you point out, they have a whole list of these labels that we have to avoid if we're going to stay out of prosecution and persecution. But it's not just in New York City where it's actually illegal for a person to refer to an individual by Ms. or Mr. that's appropriate to their biological sex, but it's happening in Virginia as well, where a French teacher at West Point High School was fired for refusing to refer to a transgender student by his or her preferred gender rather than by her biological gender at birth. It's happening on our doorstep.
Absolutely. This is the latest bitter fruit of the sexual revolution. It's the idea that genders are not only interchangeable when it comes to sexual relationships, but that the gender of any given person is malleable, that it's just a psychological concept as opposed to a biological, physiological fact. Dean, this is an assault on truth, and we need to refuse to give in to it.
Well, I'm with you, Rita, but you also then go on to talk about the need for civilized discourse on subjects like these. What do you mean by civilized discourse?
Well, we've already discussed the importance of respectful, civilized discourse when it comes to public policy debate. What I'm referring to here is something different. I'm referring to the general lack of courtesy, civility, and respect in our most common conversations with friends, acquaintances, and even total strangers. The ability to communicate our thoughts and emotions in intelligent and creative language is a skill that requires education, discipline, and lots of practice. And we ought to be leading the charge to recover this skill in our culture. We should never stop responding to vulgarity and obscenity with shock and disgust. We should never just get used to it. I like to repeat the conviction of the Dowager Countess of Downton Abbey on the old program, Downton Abbey, and she said, "Vulgarity is no substitute for wit." And I say that often to my children.
Good. Well, Rita, then you take another page out of Wilberforce's playbook, and you suggest that we have something in our community, someone who will band together to work toward making goodness fashionable. And I love the list of values that you want to promote. Let's go through some of those.
Sure. First is to foster and encourage worship of the Creator according to the direction directive of an individual's own conscience, religious freedom, and freedom of conscience.
To foster and encourage that pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty, again, I really appreciate a quote that you use in autographing your books that I referred to earlier. This is a different quotation from Philippians, where you say, "Whatever things are honorable, just, pure, lovely, and worthy of praise, think about these things and practice them that you might have peace." I love that one, Rita.
I also recommend fostering and encouraging the recognition that every human life is precious and inherently valuable.
And to extol the virtue and significance of permanent exclusive marriage between a man and a woman is a unique, comprehensive union. That's another one of these values that you want us to pursue as a community. And then you devoted an entire chapter to the permanence and purity of natural marriage because it makes such an important contribution to the family and to society as a whole. Its importance cannot be overstated, and we ignore it at our own peril.
Absolutely. Well, that brings us to number 5 in my list, which is to practice and promote private charity for the needy members of our community as a natural result of private religion and morality. We cannot overlook that one.
Well, and then, Rita, the next one you referred to is to foster and encourage the understanding that work is a human good. We've already talked about that, that there's dignity and value in every type of lawful work that uplifts humanity in some form.
Absolutely. Number 7 is to promote high quality music, movies, books, television shows, and other forms of entertainment that foster or encourage virtue. That's a big one because entertainment is all around us. That's such an important part of our culture. We can't overlook it.
Well, and that takes hard work because it's sometimes difficult to find. But then you go on in a similar way to reject and oppose the promotion of immoral sexual behavior, whether that's in music, movies, books, television shows, or other forms of entertainment. We have to take a stand against those.
Yes. Number 9 is to reject and oppose businesses or industries that promote the view of women and girls as just sexual objects, as well as those that promote or condone the destruction of innocent human life. We can make a difference when we do this.
And then finally, number 10, we need to take action to oppose and to reject the use of obscenity, vulgarity, and profanity, as well as the use of racial or ethnic slurs in conversation, whether public or private. Then you close, interestingly, Rita, you close with a chapter about money.
Yeah, I say a word about money, and I really think if we're serious about the commitments that we just described above, those 10 values, it's time for us to put our money where our mouths are. We as conservatives have a tremendous power of the purse, and we should be mindful about what we are promoting with our spending.
And there's a website I think that people can go to. It's called Second, that's numeral 2, ND Vote, secondvote.com.
Thanks again to our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and our good friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. Thank you all for listening and also for your encouragement and financial support. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. If you would like to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, go to valleyfamilyforum.org and click on the link to Crossroads on the homepage. I'm Rita Peters with Dean Welty and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.